Our friend Dolphus Ramser was born and raised in Concord, North Carolina, a town so rich with history that it provided the inspiration for his independent record label and management company. So great was the city's influence on Ramser that he continues to live and work in Concord today. With a full-time staff located in both North Carolina and California, he and his team always put their clients' music first, work as hard as they can, and have fun along the way. Visit Ramser.com to learn more.
Hey, Bob. Do you ever pay attention to historic markers?
Well, yeah, I'm kind of drawn to them. When I drive down the road, if my wife and I are going on a trip and we pass one, we'll often swing back around and see what it said. Yeah, definitely captivated by them.
You ever think about where they come from?
Well, I just imagine they were always there, right? Something of note happened in a particular spot, and the townspeople got together, and they put a little wooden sign maybe first, and then they come and raise some money and put a piece of granite there or a metal sign at some point.
You don't think that it, magically, if you do something historically, it just springs out of the ground?
Right, practically, right. Yeah.
Well, I've been thinking a lot about this one particular marker, and in today's episode, I wanted to track that down and figure out exactly why this marker said what it said and where it came from. On the corner of 4th Avenue and Commerce Street in downtown Nashville, there's a historic marker that I noticed every time I walk past it. It's dedicated to a man who you've probably never heard of, but whose life story explains a lot about the United States in the mid-19th century. I'm going to read the marker's text, and I want you to think about the impression it leaves of the man and his place in history. Here it is. William Walker, Gray-Eyed Man of Destiny. Born May 8, 1824, Walker moved to this site from 6th Avenue North in 1840. In early life, he was doctor, lawyer, and journalist. He invaded Mexico in 1853 with 46 men and proclaimed himself president of Lower Republic of California. Led forces into Nicaragua in 1855, was elected its president in 1856. An attempt to wage war on Honduras was captured and executed September 12, 1860. Now keep this version of William Walker in your mind, but let's add a little depth. In episode 17 of The Road to Now, we spoke about Walker in our conversation with Dr. Carlos Alemán, who is a specialist on the history of Nicaragua at Samford University.
In the 1850s, right, Nicaragua is in another civil war, and they're looking for someone to help them end it. So Nicaraguans find William Walker, and they tell him, hey, can you come down here and help us win this war? And so he gets down to Nicaragua, proceeds to help win the war, and then within a year, have himself elected president of Nicaragua. Ultimately, he made a mess of things. He wanted to reestablish slavery, which had already been abolished, make English the official language.
Nice to meet you. I'm William Walker.
And within 2 years, every single Central American nation builds an alliance to overthrow him.
One of the reasons he was overthrown was because he threatened the shipping lines that ran through Nicaragua.
Well, he took away Vanderbilt's.
Right. So he ends up angering Cornelius Vanderbilt, who coincidentally ends up funding a university in Nashville.
And he also funds the Central American nations to help take out Walker. Walker's interesting, too, because Walker is this kind of person who tries to come back, right? He comes back 2 years later, 1858, and he's captured, and he's summarily executed by the Hondurans.
Why did Walker take the drastic move of reestablishing slavery more than 3 decades after it had been abolished in Nicaragua? Because he was what Americans in the 19th century called a filibusterer. For Walker and others like him, seizing foreign land was not only a way to enhance their own prestige, but a way to secure slavery's foothold in the Western Hemisphere. Walker's long-term goal was to see Nicaragua annexed into the United States, where it would provide more pro-slavery votes in Congress. If this sounds crazy to you, go read up on it. I'll suggest you start with a book on the history of Texas. When it comes to history, sometimes the silence is just as powerful as the noise. It's true that Walker was a doctor, lawyer, and journalist, but it's also true he was a filibusterer. He did lead troops into Nicaragua, but he also used violence to reimpose slavery on the nation. And he provoked an international conflict that cost many lives and destabilized Central America. In fact, President James Buchanan once described Walker as having, quote, done more injury to the commercial and political interests of the United States than any living man. I knew who William Walker was the first time I saw this marker, so what struck me was not what the marker said about him, but what it didn't say. What we remember and what we forget is a series of conscious decisions made long after people and the events have passed. The marker might not tell us much about William Walker's life, but it does tell a story about how we memorialize the past and how that changes over time. There is one additional line on the marker that I did not read earlier. It reads, quote, "The Historical Commission of Metropolitan Nashville and Davidson County, number 35, erected 1970. A few weeks ago, I decided it was finally time to figure out how historical markers are established and who was responsible for this Walker marker. So I gave the Historical Commission a call and went down to their office to learn more.
My name is Jessica Reeves. I'm a historic preservationist with the Metro Historical Commission, and I've been here off and on in various capacities for about 2 years over the past 3.5 years.
So could you start by explaining to us, if I wanted to get a historic marker created, what's the process?
So the majority of our historical markers, people know of an event, or they see a building, or they read some interesting fact, and they come to us and say, hey, I think this would be a great historical marker. We say, that would be wonderful. It costs $2,500.
Oh, wow.
And, yes. If you provide us with the research and the money, then we do the editing to get it down to the correct character count. It's 480 characters, which is about 80 to 100 words, depending on how big your words are. It takes about 4 to 6 months total, start to finish, from the time you have the idea and bring it to us, for you to do the research, for us to do the editing, to take it to our commission. We have a commission that meets once a month. Okay. There's a marker committee within that commission. The marker committee looks at it. The two things that we really want to know is it significant and is it accurate?
Okay.
So significance is subjective.
Right.
Accuracy, not so much. We want to know that we can prove every fact that is on the marker. So if someone has a question and says, well, I think this person did X, Y, Z, or this was the first person who did this, then we can go to our file that we keep here and pull it out and say, well, this is where we got that fact. And sometimes we get it wrong. Sometimes we think someone is the first person to do something.
Right.
We find out later that they're not. You know, and we change markers, we update markers, we change the text. I think there were several buildings in Nashville people thought William Strickland built. He built everything, apparently. He did not. So we had to go back and change a couple markers and update those and say, we learned something new. It's just like, you know, academic scholarship. You're always learning new things. So we're always updating and wanting to make sure that we're portraying the most accurate contemporary version of history.
So have you ever encountered a situation in which you discovered that a marker needed to be updated and someone fought you on it?
Not yet.
Not yet.
Not yet. I'm sure it will happen at some point. I know that markers have big changes have been made to them, but mostly what we know now is he died in 1914, not 1913, or
right.
Retired in this year or something like that. So they're pretty small changes. Nothing really big since I've been here. But Who knows? It could always happen.
Yeah, that's interesting. I like that you're keeping the door open for that.
Yes, of course.
So the first steps are clear. Get $2,500, find someone who is significant in Nashville, and write up the text. I asked Jessica what happened after that.
I and this office will fact check first.
Okay.
So we try to stop things before they get to the commission if we don't think they are accurate or significant, because we are a local commission. We always want to make a connection to broader state or national things that are going on, but really it needs to be significant to Nashville. A couple of checks are in place
right.
for the first email to me, or once you send me your first draft, we start looking through the sources, start looking at the text and say, does this really meet
right.
our level? And there is nothing written or codified or anything like that. It is pretty subjective, but we know what we've done before, and we know, I think we have sort of an idea of what significance we're right. looking for. Then it goes to the commission. The commission is appointed. I think there are 15 members.
Okay.
They're appointed by the mayor, but they do represent, you know, a cross section of people from different council districts, people who are living in different places, doing different things. So we're not just getting, you know, all the same perspective
right.
On things. So we'll meet. There are four or five people on the marker committee. They will look at it. And there is sort of a trust between them and us in the office that if it comes to them that we've vetted it
right,
properly.
Right.
But, you know, I mean, they can always ask questions. Is this significant enough? Maybe we need to change the language a little bit more to convey the significance and make sure that anybody who walks down the street and sees this marker is going to know that this person mattered to Nashville's history.
Have they ever turned down something?
Not in my experience. It hasn't been turned down.
Jessica knew I wanted to talk about the Walker marker whenever I got there. So I started by telling her the full story of William Walker and then rereading her the text.
That's much nicer than the story you just told.
It's much nicer. So, it doesn't necessarily say much about the event itself, right? It doesn't necessarily say much about why Walker matters to Nashville history.
Right.
Right? This is a guy who far more significant for his impact upon Central America right. and U.S. Central American relations. Is there ever a point at which a marker should be edited, not based upon the year that someone's born, but right. based upon the fact that it gives an overly rosy version of someone? Or do you think there's ever a point at which a marker should be taken down?
Interesting. I don't know. That obviously that's why you're here. That's a really good question. Because it does, we could write this again today. This was done in 1970.
Okay.
1970.
So it was shortly after you established, so somebody was ready to go right. with this.
It was the 35th marker.
Right.
As well. So yeah, within 3 years.
I asked Jessica what she knew about the historical commission at the time the Walker marker had been dedicated, and if they had any documents that could fill me in on why they had decided to make that marker to William Walker.
They established the commission, like the commission that votes, like the appointed commission, before they even had staff members.
So you're saying there was a period before, like, your position existed.
Right.
So anyone could go before this commission of people who were not primarily historians.
Right. I don't know what the makeup of the commission would have been at that okay. time. They could have been more, it could have been more historians on the commission.
Okay.
If you didn't have staff members to do anything, then you would probably want historians on your commission to right. make those decisions. The other thing is, from the 1990s, all my files are a couple of inches thick. There are lots of papers. We're putting everything in there. If you send an email, we're recording everything. I have just slips of paper that have, you know, notes scrawled on right. them, stuck in these things. The early markers, since there were no staff members, obviously,
right.
not as much.
Before we wrapped up, I couldn't resist it. I wanted to know if it was possible to change that marker.
So if someone were to come with an edit mm-hmm. and suggest a change, mm-hmm. would the burden of $2,500 be on them, or would that be something that was considered built into the price of the initial monument?
It would be on the person. The cost covers the cost of the marker at that time. So if you wanted to edit the William Walker marker, that would be on whoever is proposing the edits.
I realized as we were having this conversation, I was like, she totally thinks I'm trying to edit this marker. I'm not.
No,
I'm
just, no, just, no, just, and it's totally fine.
That's
it's
not
totally
my goal.
Fine.
Right? I mean, maybe after this episode airs, then maybe people will be
maybe
like, hey, we could, you know, that'd be worth doing.
I mean, but, I think it's an interesting question, because I'm sure if you don't know anything about William Walker, don't know who he is, you see this marker, that's all you know.
Yeah.
You're probably not going to go to the library and look right. up anything else about him or Google his name or, you know, see what his Wikipedia entry says. And it might not say more than that. I don't know. I haven't checked. But yeah, that's sort of the impression that you're left with of him. And I think it's a very limited amount of characters. So you can't right. always tell
sure.
as much as you want. But I do think we would have written it differently today.
All right, Bob, you just listened to my interview with Jessica Reeves down at the Metro Historical Commission. Any thoughts?
Well, I mean, it's it is crazy how subjective it is to determine what is historically significant.
Right.
And how it's significant, right? We just went through this whole Charlottesville thing and the ongoing debate over Civil War monuments. And I went to the Richard Stockton College of New Jersey. We didn't even have a statue of Richard Stockton. We had a bust of him. But he was for those that don't know, he was a signer of the Declaration of Independence. He also owned slaves. And they took the bust of Richard Stockton out of the library at Stockton University. So, right. And then, you know, more famously, recently we've been talking about these Civil War monuments. And the interesting thing about those are, when were they put up?
Right.
It's not that they're not significant in some way, but when were they put up and what message were they erected to send and to who? Right. Exactly. So it's really interesting. I want to know more about this William Walker monument. It was erected in 1970. Why? Right. What makes that significant?
Well, here's the thing. The Metro Historical Commission had very few documents on it. And I kind of went on a circular movement between there. I then went to the Nashville City Archives or the city documents and the library downtown. I then contacted the Metro Clerk's office. None of them have really any more information on this marker. But what I was able to obtain was a list of the members of the Metro Historical Commission when the marker was selected and essentially set up to be built. And here's what I found out. You want to know who the members are, Bob?
Sure.
Let's see what we can deduce about these folks. One of the people whose actually name was on the few documents in the file, his name was Rita C. Goff. He was a civil engineer for the Metropolitan Government of Nashville and Davidson County in the Water Service Division. He was also really interested in history. He wrote a few pieces on Andrew Jackson. Not a professional historian, though. He wrote mostly on the South and published in things such as the Civil War Times. Second member, Paul Beasley. He won some awards for preservation and for achievement, but one of the things he did was worked with Civil War history, worked on a movie, The Battlefields of Tennessee, 1861 to 1865, and according to one of his peers, quote, spent more time than anyone, including Hank Williams Jr., in collecting mini balls and other battlefield relics.
Okay.
The third one, Bert Elmore, who was, I had to track all these people down. I had to use obituaries and things like this because there were no records, really. Bert Elmore became director of Nashville Parks and Recreation in 1957 and was on the steering committee for the Battle of Nashville Centennial Commemoration in 1964. Fourth member, Mrs. Andrew Benedict, also known as Sarah Bryan Benedict. I should note she is listed as Mrs. Andrew Benedict in the commission's records. She was an active member of the Junior League of Nashville. She was kind of a socialite, and she was a part of the Daughters of the American Revolution and the National Society of Colonial Dames of America in Tennessee. And finally, Mrs. Hal Swan, whose first name I cannot find. She was most notable for being married to a man who had purchased a piece of land where he believed Confederate soldiers had camped during the Battle of Nashville. Together, they built a home on that site called Rebel Retreat.
Well, there you go on that one.
Bob, is there anything you could say that would indicate particular areas of interest on behalf of the people on this committee?
Each of them had a interest in the southern side of Civil War history.
Exactly.
You would say they're Confederates, if you will.
You might say that a couple that builds their home on a Confederate campground and names it Rebel Retreat might have some affinity for the southern cause, huh?
Yeah. I think I've been to a bar called Rebel Retreat. It's been a long time.
So here we have it. People become frustrated because they say people are trying to rewrite history. But what you should never forget is that someone wrote it in the first place. And oftentimes their own interests are reflected in it.
Yeah, the whole story is never told.
It isn't. And even I can't tell this whole story because there are no documents that demonstrate why they did it. This is why in my classes I always say you have to consider the source. And why I always say that the silence is often just as powerful as the noise. Because we can write a marker like the one about Walker, and we can list real things he did, but if you leave those blank spots in the middle, you're not necessarily telling a full story. And you go back and look at who was behind writing this marker and seeing that it was established, I think you can perhaps see that they were not looking at a full picture of the past.
it kind of makes me feel better about what goes on today as far as misinformation and the claims of fake news and little white political lies. And people have always been doing this, right? They've just done it in different ways at different times. In the Civil War monuments and the William Walker here in particular, it was a matter of omitting things. So that's another way of just falsifying history. And, you know, it's also a little depressing that when you're young and you're enamored with American history and you begin to study it, you want to learn what happened. And then you get really deep into it and you've been doing it for a while and you realize how subjective the telling of history can be.
We are all subjects. None of us are free from bias. We all have our own perspectives. The point thing you have to realize is I'm going to have to do a lot of work for this work for myself. And I'm going to have to figure out which documents I want to engage on my own. And on top of that, which historians do I trust? Which ones have established credibility? You can't just listen to any source that's out there. You've got to figure out who has credibility and really dig into that. And I think the big takeaway here is this. How we write history matters because at any time, it reflects who we are. Making monuments or taking down monuments, that's a process that's gone on for a long time. Each generation gets to decide what parts of their history are the part that they're proud of and the parts that they see the most important parts of themselves in. History is always changed in these terms. Not the facts, not the people, but how it is that we decide we want to show the world who we were at the time. So when people challenge these monuments, they challenge these markers, never forget, you're not leaving these people out. You're not erasing them from history. You're not showing who they were so much as you're showing who you were. As I was working on this piece about the William Walker marker, my friend and colleague Pippa Holloway was taking the lead in erecting a new historical marker in Nashville. The story this marker tells is quite different than the one that started this episode. Here's Pippa reading the text.
Penny Campbell, 1953 to 2014. An activist for LGBT rights and advocate for people with mental health and housing issues, Campbell co-organized Tennessee's delegation to the 1987 March on Washington for Lesbian and Gay Rights and Nashville's 1988 Pride Parade at a time when many feared discrimination and violence. Daughter of civil rights activist Will Campbell, she was the lead plaintiff in Campbell v. Sundquist, 1996, which overturned a law criminalizing private, consensual sexual acts between same-sex adults.
As with any marker, there's a lot that isn't said here. So I asked Pippa to share more about Penny Campbell and why her life merited a historical marker.
There's a couple things about her story that I think are really notable. Penny Campbell was a student at Vanderbilt, a divinity school student at Vanderbilt, in the 1980s. And she was one of the most out gay students on campus. And this was in a time in which very few people were openly gay. I actually just learned recently that she helped write the inclusiveness policy that is still used by the Divinity School that involves inclusiveness on issues of sexual orientation, race, gender identity, and things like that. So she has made a lasting mark on Vanderbilt and the Divinity School. She organized Nashville's first gay pride parades. There were some gay, pride events in Nashville prior to her leading the organization of this parade, but they were really small private events like the gay picnic in the park kind of thing.
Right.
But Penny in the mid-1980s worked with other local people to launch Nashville's first pride celebration that featured a parade. Prior to that, gay-themed meeting events had been really private, but this is a public citywide event that she helped organize. She also organized Nashville's delegation to the 1987 March on Washington for Lesbian and Gay Rights, which I actually attended as a very young undergraduate.
That's awesome.
A lot of stuff about her didn't make the marker, right? You can only have a very limited number of words there. Penny also organized Nashville's first gay marriage protest. I think it's important when we think about gay and lesbian history to remember the pain, the fear, the violence that people lived with in the past, and of course still live with today, right? We want to craft narratives that are happy and progressive and show people thriving under adversity, but at the same time, that adversity is a pretty heavy burden sometimes. So that's why I have the text in the marker. And I was really determined to have something like this in here that says she did this at a time when many feared discrimination and violence. And we really shouldn't forget that that was a reality for many, many people in the 1980s. Even to the extent that when she was one of the plaintiffs in Campbell v. Sundquist, the state Supreme Court case that overturned Tennessee's crimes against nature laws, there were five plaintiffs on the case. Two of them went under Jane Doe and John Doe because they were so concerned about being publicly identified. They might be fired, they might be disowned, they might lose their housing. So in the late 80s, it was a brave act to have your name in court as suing the state over a civil rights violation. She was apparently just a wonderful person. And, you know, she came from a family of activists, right? Her dad was a civil rights activist and a leader, Will Campbell. And so that's another neat thing about this marker is that it connects the gay and lesbian movement with the civil rights movement. So this is a marker in a way, it's a marker about the legacy of the civil rights movement. That a civil rights activist, Will Campbell, raised the daughter who would go and speak out for lesbian and gay rights. So I see this as part of Nashville civil rights history as well.
Pippa put a lot of work into this marker, so I asked her why she thinks historical markers matter.
In terms of the local aspect, it's a reminder that, you know, our neighborhood, our city, our local stories are connected to national stories. And that's something that we live every day. It puts local stories in contexts, which then gives them a heightened significance. So for example, Campbell v. Sundquist was a Tennessee State Supreme Court case that overturned Tennessee's crimes against nature laws. You might say to yourself, who cares? Lawrence v. Texas is going to come along 7 years later and overturn them on a national level. But Lawrence, the Supreme Court in Lawrence, actually relied on the fact that states like Tennessee had overturned their laws to demonstrate evidence of a national trend towards getting rid of these laws. So that's a really concrete example in a legal history context of how a local story changes the national landscape. And I guess, you know, the other thing obviously is that making history visible on the landscape is about who matters in society. Who we are as a people, to some extent, is about how we remember ourselves and how we tell our history. That landscape has to involve all of the diversity of our people in our history. And so when you put up a marker, you remind people of that history and of the different kinds of struggles and the different kinds of peoples that have contributed to our understanding of the Constitution, of our understanding of ourselves, of our understanding of our communities.
Since Pippa put a lot of work into making this Penny Campbell marker happen, I wondered if she thought there was ever a time when a marker should be taken down.
Yeah, sure. They're a product of the moments they're in, right? And historical markers do work. And I'll be pretty honest, I want this marker to do various kinds of work. I certainly have an agenda for this marker. I want it to do historical work. I want it to do a work in our society. And I'm grateful that professional historians and the Historical Commission agreed to this marker. And on some level, let's be honest, are endorsing the agenda that I'm proposing, right? If they thought that gay rights was a horrible thing and gay people should go back in the closet and hide and suffer in eternal damnation, then they wouldn't have let this marker happen, right? And so this is part of a political project. I'll be honest about that. And I can see other historical markers were parts of other political projects that we may no longer agree with. And there's no reason not to remove them from the landscape if we no longer endorse that political project.
It may seem strange that an episode that started with the 19th century filibuster concluded with the 20th century civil rights activist. But if you think about it, it makes sense. Walker and his marker, that's where we were. Campbell and her marker, that's where we are now. Penny Campbell didn't fight in any wars or proclaim herself the president of any countries. Her cause was civil rights. She was an activist for AIDS patients and fought for the rights of the disabled. She was, simply put, the type of person who makes a community better for everyone to live in. Half a century from now, when someone stops to look at that marker, they'll learn something about Penny Campbell, but they'll also learn a lot about Nashville in 2017. And I'm proud to say that I was here, and that Penny and Pippa were my neighbors. The Road to Now is produced by Bob Crawford, Ben Sawyer, and Ian Scotta. Today's music is by How I Became the Bomb. This episode was edited by Ben Sawyer. We are much obliged to Pippa Holloway, Jessica Reeves, and the Metro Nashville Historical Commission for being so helpful in making this episode. We'd also like to say a special thanks to our supporters on Patreon, with a special shout out to our Washingtonians, Eric King, Tanya Marsh, Mary Hawking, Paul Ayler, Tim and Caitlin Wells, Christopher Willis, Peggy Donica, and Fig White,
You guys are incredible. And finally, I'd like to give a shout out to the good people at the Well Coffee House in downtown Nashville who stopped what they were doing to help me with this episode. Those guys make a mean cup of iced coffee. If you have any more information on the Walker Marker or just want to share your thoughts on this episode, please go to theroadtonow.com/episodes, find episode 75, and let us know what you think in the comments on that page. For Bob Crawford, this is Dr. Benjamin Sawyer. Thanks for listening to The Road to Now. Take care.